Hi, I'm David Manti, and welcome to a new episode of the Today in Manufacturing podcast. With me this week are Jeff Ranke and Anna Wells. We each have more than 15 years of experience covering the manufacturing industry. Every week, we take the five most popular stories on our websites and discuss the implications they have on the industry going forward. But before we get into that, please make sure to like, share, and subscribe to the podcast. You can also help us out a lot by leaving the podcast a positive review on whatever platform you use or just a simple thumbs up on YouTube. If you want to email the podcast, you can reach any of us at Jeff, David, or Anna at IEN.com with email the podcast in the subject line. Talking about YouTube, you can subscribe to us at IEN Magazine so you can get a notification whenever we go live every Thursday at 2 p.m. Also, if you would like to sponsor the podcast and become a Today in Manufacturing podcast partner, you can reach out to Today in Manufacturing podcast president Tom Lynch at Tom at IEN.com with sponsor the podcast in the subject line. So that's a lot, Anna.
What do you think it's like to be the president of a podcast?
I think it's great up there.
Like, what are you even doing?
I think it's great up there. Like, you do a lot of pointing, you know, a lot of delegating.
A lot of like check marks and approvals and things like that.
Yes, yeah. A lot of recommendations over episode content.
Right, yes.
Yes.
It's exactly what's taking place.
Jeff, how are you doing this week?
Good, man.
Yeah?
Yeah.
That's good. All right. Well, before we jump into our first story this week, we have another word from our sponsor. Hi, I'm David Manti, and with me today is Rob Milner from FLIR. Rob, we hear a lot about the machine whisperers out in the industry, but there's a very simple problem out there that these machine whisperers still can't catch what they can't hear. So what can we do about it?
Well, we give those guys and everyone around them the ability to see sound and save.
You're going to see sound?
You can, yeah. We can actually make sound appear like a hotspot on a visual image. Makes it really easy to use, and anyone can do it.
That is incredible. I look forward to talking about it more. Please join us. Join Rob and I for our discussion, Acoustic Imaging for Manufacturing, How to Capture Cost Savings Through Sound. And we're back. And just another point of clarity. I was apparently mistaken. I want to make sure everyone knows, our friends and viewers and listeners at home know, that it's actually industrial media president Tom Lynch that I'm talking about. To reach out to for the Today in Manufacturing podcast is just one of many brands and products that we have to offer you. And please reach out to Tom at IEN.com with sponsor the podcast, which is one of many things that you manage in the subject line. Now, about Teledyne FLIR.
I just always appreciate how David is so good at just letting things go. Just rolling with it when things are pointed out to him.
Yeah, that
doesn't
was just
bother him.
That was me narrating the water falling off the duck's back. Also, a reminder, up to 30% of your plant's total compressed air capacity is being lost to leaks right now. The air is cheap, but the power isn't. So download this new video podcast on demand now. Between myself, it's conversation with myself and Rob Milner. We talk about how manufacturers are using acoustic cameras to catch these problems in real time. Our first story this week. China sanctions two U.S. defense companies, says they support arms sales in Taiwan. China last week sanctioned a pair of U.S. defense companies for supporting arms sales to Taiwan. As part of the sanctions, China froze the assets of General Atomics Aeronautical Systems and General Dynamics Land Systems in the country. Company management can't even enter the country. Taiwan is a prickly subject as China claims the democratic territory as its own. General Dynamics has a relatively small aviation operation in China, but the company is also part of the team that makes Abrams tanks, like the ones Taiwan just bought to resist a Chinese invasion. General Atomics makes Predator and Reaper drones used by the U.S. military, but it's not clear if they are supplying Taiwan. While Beijing has made similar threats in the past, it's rare for them to go through with it, Jeff, especially with a shaky economy.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many things you could dive into here. I mean, books have literally been written on the U.S.-China economic relations and the trade deficit, and then you throw Taiwan in there, and you're really dealing with a lot of different factors influencing things here. To me, overall, this feels like a lot of posturing from China. They've been taking a lot of hits here when it comes to the U.S., and some of the embargoes that they've been reinforcing, some of the sanctions that they've been enforcing in terms of not letting chip manufacturers go into China, mm-hmm. being very restrictive of things, you know, the whole deal with, I'm going to say the name wrong again,
Huawei.
Huawei, thank you. All of that, and I think this is, at some point, they felt like they needed to say something or do something.
Mm-hmm.
Overall, I think one of the things, people get very, very anxious and maybe a little bit overly paranoid when it comes to relationships between China and the U.S. The reality is, from an economic and business perspective, these two need each other very, very much.
Yeah.
So there is a lot that they're always going to be doing to sort of push the limit. And I think a lot of this dialogue from the U.S. perspective is positive.
Mm-hmm.
It did start with President Trump and some of the sanctions that he put on U.S.-China trade, which I think have been good. Mm-hmm. President Biden has continued with those things. And I think those have been helpful in a lot of instances. But what you see here with China going after these three companies, in addition to the five that they actually had some sanctions against earlier on in the year.
Okay.
They're minimal.
Yeah.
And they're not a big deal because they're not putting these U.S. companies into a situation where it's going to be disastrous to their business, long-term or short-term.
Mm-hmm.
It does kind of hinder China a little bit because a lot of them are focused on commercial aircraft, which they're still struggling to build up internally within China. They're still figuring out how to build planes. Now, you didn't notice this coming against some of the bigger aerospace suppliers like Boeing.
Yeah.
Okay. So, because they still are very dependent on them to build up a lot of that infrastructure. So, I think it is posturing. There's definitely a pride thing here with Taiwan and China that we'll probably never really understand. It's also not forcing the U.S. to do anything official when it comes to China. We sort of have this, I don't know, under the table handshake going on with them right now. So, there's a lot of political things here that have involved in making this a weird combination of factors. At the end of the day, I don't think a lot is going to change. I think it is just China trying to look a little bit tougher.
Yeah. I actually had the same thought where it's kind of surprising with some of the sanctions that have gone kind of the other way that we haven't seen more of it coming in, like in response.
I mean, at the end of the day, I think I was looking at some recent numbers here. The U.S. imports something like $150 billion to China. China is counting on us to buy like $360 billion of their stuff still. So you can talk about all this tension. There's still a lot of buying and selling going on here.
Yeah. And when you're talking about these sanctions, they are relatively smaller footprints in China. And one thing, I guess, that nobody ever wants to see is more political turmoil in the global landscape. And I think that with stories like this, there's always that unease that comes with it.
Yeah. And I think, like, I agree with Jeff that this is posturing and that these two trade partners do need each other immensely. And I don't think we're going to see a lot change either in the near term. However, I do see companies, at least anecdotally, and then according to some research too that's out in the market, just feeling a little bit shakier about their business ties with China. And I can see why. I mean, so the PRD statement about this basically said the continued U.S. arms sales to China's Taiwan region seriously violates the One China principle and the provisions of the three China-U.S. joint communiques interfere in China's internal affairs and undermine China's sovereignty and territorial integrity. So to me, the bottom line there is, like, this is logic that they can apply to lots of companies, right? Mm-hmm. And you know, the U.S. does that too. We use words like potential national security threat.
Oh, yeah.
That we can just sort of blanket over, and, you know, you can hide a lot behind that phrase to squash something that you don't want to be there or to send a message. So I do think that if companies are feeling a little bit shaky about this, I can see why. I can see why you're hearing more about companies wanting to decouple their supply chains from China, because, you know, they have to consider their economic interests here. And, you know, we saw this with the situation with Russia, and they're not the same situation, but they do have some similarities in terms of freezing assets, a territory that does not want to be annexed by China. There, you know, like, I think that companies all need to be mindful of the fact that, you know, maybe some of this business could go away at a moment's notice. We really don't know. Mm-hmm. I do think that they have more to lose, to your point, than Russia did. But that's not to say that more of these types of things couldn't take place, like, you know, before it gets to that point. So I don't know. I just think that, like, taking those efforts to maybe decouple their supply chains from China, and as you're seeing more and more propensity for this economy in China to be more self-serving, maybe a little bit more inconsistent, I think companies need to keep a close eye on that as well. I know that it's not like a house on fire type of scenario, but I do see it as a warning of things that could be to come. And I think, you know, companies may want to view it that way as well.
Well, and while Taiwan has been investing heavily in its own defense industry, I think that any U.S. company that is doing any sort of defense-related business in Taiwan should be particularly on alert, just because, talk about what happened in Russia with the Ukrainian conflict, there were those early dominoes that started to fall, and it's just like, well, they're not going to do that to everybody, right?
And they did.
The U.S., to that point, still remains Taiwan's most important source of diplomatic support and supplier of military hardware, from fighter jets to air defense systems. So, you know, just if you're in that mil-aero category, proceed with caution.
Yeah, I think the timing of this was also interesting due to the fact that I think Congress is voting this weekend like a $2 billion aid package focused on the Indo-Asian area.
Okay.
Which is, you know, Taiwan.
Yeah. So. Okay. No, it's a whole area they're looking at.
Sure.
They just fall in it. It's a little island. All right. Our next most popular story this week. Olympic track uniforms spark online debate. American track and field athletes have about 48 uniform options when it comes to their Olympic uniforms. But one, a high-cut leotard with a narrow margin for error on the bikini line, has triggered some debate. Now, Nike is back in hot water once again, or still in hot water following the Fanatics jersey debacle in Major League Baseball. A British athlete asked, "Was any female athlete consulted in this team kit?" Well, the answer is yes. Nike actually consulted with several athletes, including world champion sprinter Sha'Carri Richardson. Nike says it worked, quote, directly with athletes throughout every stage of the design process. Olympic pole vaulting champion Katie Moon says female athletes have at least 20 different combinations of uniforms to compete in, including styles made for men, their male counterparts. Jeff, so is this just rabble-rousing or legitimate outrage?
I think everybody has a right to express their opinion. And if that opinion comes in the form of outrage, that's fair. If that's how you want to express yourself. But if you're going to do that, you need to do some research first.
Yeah.
Okay? You need to express the fact that, in my opinion, this is what this demonstrates. Mm-hmm. Because there's going to be a lot of people who look at these remarks and also don't do the research. And then this whole thing perpetuates into becoming more of a statement on probably what was a bad marketing decision than a much higher level social inequality type dynamic. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the biggest problem we have right now when it comes to putting out our feelings, whether it's on the internet. The internet is a great thing for archiving and sharing information, but there's also a responsibility that needs to come with it. Also, we need to realize that when people put this stuff out, it's their opinion.
Yeah.
It is an opinion. It's not always fact. I just want to call out one person here, and this is Lauren Fleischman. She's a two-time U.S. champion in the 5,000 meters, and she put together this long Twitter post just basically going after Nike, and I'll read a part of it here. She said, "This is not an elite athletic kit for track and field. It's a costume born of patriarchal forces that are no longer welcome or needed to get eyes on women's sports." I agree with her. This is not a woman that is being shown in this picture. Mm-hmm. It is a dummy. It is, again, one of many, many
mannequin.
Options.
It is a mannequin.
Mannequin. All of that. And again, this gets overblown. If she would have taken a little bit of time and seen what some of the other responses were in terms of, this is an option, this isn't being mandated, this is not what everybody is going to be wearing, this is just something we put out there. Essentially, what they did is gave Nike this great guerrilla marketing campaign that gets everybody talking about these uniforms, when quite honestly, I don't know how much we would have been if this hadn't come up.
Yeah.
So was this part of Nike's plan to get everybody talking about it? I don't know. I mean, this is a big company. They made a really strange decision here. The other thing that bothers me about this is it brings another negative sentiment on at a time when we're really seeing a lot of positive things going on in female sports.
Yeah.
You know, my wife is sick of hearing about Caitlin Clark. I get it.
Yeah.
But the reality is the eyes that it brought to that women's Final Four was great. Mm-hmm. And then who cares if it was men or women playing? It was really good basketball.
Yeah.
That's the takeaway there. These are amazing athletes, and that's what the focus should be on. The fact that they have sponsors and they have a big company like this in their corner working for them should ideally be a bigger part of the conversation, not the fact that they screwed up on one uniform.
Well, and I don't think that they screwed. Yeah, I don't think that they screwed up on the uniform option, right? Because they offered so many after consulting athletes as to what they might want. So I go back to Katie Moon, right? Where she says, if it was our only choice, yeah, it would be sexist, right? But even if it's with the best of intentions, you're ultimately attacking the female athlete's decision to wear it. So now people who actually wanted to wear that uniform because they think it'll give them the best performance possible in the arena, yeah, might think twice about it just because they fear that judgment.
I mean, that's a great point. We forget how intensely competitive these individuals are. And if that uniform they truly feel gives them an advantage,
yeah,
that's what they're going
to
do.
Well, and just another point on that. What was crazy to me is that, okay, so Nike partners with more than 100 federations across team and individual sports, as well as supporting hundreds of individual athletes that are all going to compete in the games. They have an incredible Olympic footprint. These designs, this is according to Nike, are, quote, based on 4D motion capture data algorithmically honed with 4D motion capture data algorithmically honed with pixel level precision and engineered specifically for each competition. They were truly obsessing over every detail. And so I just, Anna, when it comes to that type of precision craftsmanship, I think that sometimes we need to see that there was a little bit more to this equation than just like be a sexy uniform.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. You guys both raised some good points. There's tons of good points in here. I just, from the female perspective on this, I guess, like, and I'm not trying to like trump card it or anything. I'm really not, but.
It is the trump card. Okay.
I agree with Jeff that the real issue here is marketing, right? First of all, like, why select this particular uniform as serving as the face of this rollout when there are 20 options? To me, this indicates like whoever was in charge of this promotion took a weird chance because it just seems like it is going to appeal to just a very small percentage of these athletes. I mean, there's tons of different sports involved. That's a very, very small amount of uniform. You know, I think also like the men's uniform for the exact same. I mean, there's no men's that
equivalent.
Yeah. I mean, that. Yeah. So to say that it is like for performance to me, just that falls flat to me. Because okay, if it's the best performing uniform, then why did the men not have that uniform? They don't. So, but I do think that what stood out the most, and I think what bears consideration, is that for a long time, women's clothing and swimwear has been smaller and more form fitting. And this trend has extended everywhere into children's clothing, even, you know, it's become a sore spot for so many parents who find themselves faced with this selection imbalance for their kids. I mean, you have daughters, you know, why are the shorts for girls like 3 inches shorter for like a 7-year-old girl? Why are the t-shirts cut off here? Why, you know, it reinforces this long-standing trend towards women's clothing being, I don't know, different.
Mm-hmm.
And why, you know? And yeah, I think it comes down to that long-term feeling of being objectified. And so to me, to put this front and center in the marketing campaign, I can see why people saw that and they were like, what is this, you know? And, you know, I think Nike got that response because women are exhausted by this. And it was just an odd choice to me when, you know, we're in this world where online pushback can be you know, viral and intense. And it just felt like very out of touch with this phenomenon of people being like, hey, wait a second, why do we have to Why are we given these options when, you know, I don't think people appreciate the options.
Yeah.
Because, and I don't know, in the end, I can see why there were a lot of people that were just like, enough already. This is like, stop, you know, because if that's the first thing you see, and I know you have to do the research, there's 20 options, but why is this the one you're showing me?
Well, and it wasn't the one that, I mean, I guess Nike had to release those images, but Nike has a host of images that it's had from the rollout since, and there are all different types of styles, all suited to different sports. And I mean, like when it comes to like men's wrestling, stuff like that, there are very similar, let's call it trims. Yeah, I mean men
wear a leotard. They're cut that high on the hip?
I mean, on the hip? No, that's like a one piece. But I'm just saying that there are male equivalents, not specifically in track and field, but in different sports. Like, but I mean, you're right. Like at a base level, women are not just women athletes. They are women athletes who are then sexualized. And I understand that that is wrong. I was just saying that the one thing that stood out to me in this was that there were so many options available.
Yeah, I agree. But again, at the end of the day, why am I looking at this one?
Yeah. Okay. Well, and to both your points, probably because of a calculated marketing decision.
Yeah, like a miscalculated marketing decision.
Well, that's are we going to see the evolution of like all press is good press? Like at some point, someone just had to be like, hey, we all saw what happened with Bud Light. Like there is like where you reach a threshold and then there's just a drop off where there's no coming back from it.
I don't know.
Well, I mean, there may be an unfortunate reality. Look, we've heard stories about how networks pay all this money for the Olympic coverage and don't always recoup it because people don't always tune in to some of these sports that they don't see as mainstream athletic competitions. Okay. Track and field's one of them. Maybe there is some sort of weird algorithm out there that they felt this could help get more eyeballs on the Olympics or something like that. I don't know. Yeah. You'd hope not. You'd hope we're kind of past all that, but
yeah,
I guess.
All right. Well, let's move on to our next most popular story. Toxic ingredients found in weight loss supplements. In January 2024, the FDA issued a warning about dietary supplements purchased on popular e-commerce websites like Amazon and Etsy. They were made with toxic ingredients. I'm going to forget how to say this now. Tejocote root. There it is. I looked at it and I was just like, I had that phonetically in there. And I'm like, you know what? You'll remember. Tejocote root is a Mexican root supplement marketed for weight loss. Well, an FDA analysis found that these dietary supplements labeled as this root are adulterated. Instead, they were substituted with yellow oleander, which is poisonous. The FDA contacted several sellers who initiated a recall. However, some have declined to issue a recall, including Amazon. And the FDA couldn't even reach some of these companies. Global Mix of New York didn't announce a recall until last week. Their recall now includes several brands sold into 43 different states. And it came after routine sampling revealed yellow oleander in finished products. The company stopped production and is investigating to find the root cause. The FDA continues to receive reports of adverse events related to these products, which can cause fatal cardiovascular, gastrointestinal, and neurologic problems. According to the FDA, many of these products are still available on very popular marketplaces like Amazon. So, Anna, why is it so hard to get poison off the market?
It is really hard.
It's incredibly hard.
Yeah. And every time I see a story like this, it just reinforces my opinion that the supplement industry cannot continue to go unregulated. This has been sort of the Wild West of consumer goods. And I don't think that's always widely known. Unfortunately, that leaves consumers in a very precarious position where testing is often being done after these products are on the market. And not only that, the ingredient levels can vary widely batch to batch depending on the producer, even within the same producer. Mm-hmm. And I think that the other challenge is that with retailers and e-tailers like Amazon, it is much easier to become a seller now. The checks and balances that were once there, like the barriers that were in place where a supplier had to overcome them to physically bring a product to market, the supply chain can now be much more opaque. Sometimes Amazon sellers are just boxing up goods that they've bought elsewhere, you know, like people boxing up dollar store stuff in their grandma's basement.
No, you know them. They're the people with the cartfuls in the clearance section.
Yeah.
Just filling the cart because they know it'll sell higher on Amazon.
Exactly. And, the problem is, so where do the products come from? And Amazon, we know from past studies, has trouble policing this process just due to the sheer volume of the transactions that take place every day. So that leaves the consumers being essentially lab rats in these situations. I recently read that the melatonin industry, so makers of the supplemental hormone that's meant to be like a sleep aid, mm-hmm. is being asked to voluntarily tighten their standards after studies uncovered massive disparities between products in terms of their levels. So 25 products, this was like Consumer Reports, I think, looked into this. 25 products labeled as melatonin gummies contain dangerous levels of the hormone. Some didn't contain it at all, rather used CBD. This is a product that is marketed towards children to help kids fall asleep at night. I know multiple parents that use these products.
Oh, no, you see a lot of these in like the kids' bathroom. Just mm-hmm. like that's the gummy they take before they go to bed.
Yeah, it's scary to think about. And, you know, do they know that the quality issues are just a huge question mark? Do they know that the dosages are a huge question mark? I don't know. You know, I think people look at supplements as being like pharma.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And they don't always realize that it's just somebody producing something and you're buying it. And there's really not that much more to it. So I don't know. It makes me uncomfortable knowing that the quality lapse is not uncovered until it's too late in so many circumstances here. They said the number of ER visits for melatonin supplement overdoses or missed doses or whatever was up like 400-something%.
Yeah. It's terrifying.
But this is just, you know, that's another thing, you know, just like this story of a supplement that is just doing its thing, like, mm-hmm. you know, and so I don't know. To me, and I know that not everyone is going to agree with this, but to me, I think the solution is we lose choice, but we gain safety. We like dramatically limit the number of players in something like this and allow the FDA to oversee it potentially. I mean, if we can do it with food and we can do it with pharma, it can be done. It's a matter of whether we want that to happen. And obviously, prices will go up and, you know, it changes the entire market, right? Mm-hmm. But is the kind of freedom that we want, the freedom to be poisoned by people who have no checks and balances at all. Yeah. That's really what we're dealing with here.
I don't think that's crazy at all. And I don't think you would limit choice necessarily. I mean, obviously you would limit because the bad actors would be outside of the industry or on the other side of the industry. But, you know, if you're going to give the FDA a little bit more, essentially like 30% more workload. I mean, you obviously need to invest and fund that part of the FDA. But I mean, it reminds me so much of the eye drop scandal that mm-hmm. we talked about, just in terms of when people are purchasing products like this, they think there is an inherent safety to it. When we're closer to it because we cover the industry, right? When I talk to fellow parents about the problems with melatonin, nobody's ever heard of that.
Nobody knows, yeah.
I mean, and we're talking about melatonin, something that is pretty widely used with a lot of parents. When you talk about tejocote root and white or yellow oleander, mm-hmm. no one knows what that is.
Yeah.
Like, and what also bugs me is just how much these weight loss supplements are promoted on social media. And I mean, we can get into an entirely other episode on the regulations around what is marketed on social media. Jeff understands these frustrations in terms of certain rules that make no sense, but I can't believe that they can do targeted ads towards people selling a product that is poison. Mm-hmm. Jeff, what were your thoughts on this particular story? Another thing with me is just that how far back this has gone. We're talking about years where these supplements have been available on the market and still nothing.
Well, let me read a couple things right off the FDA website. Mm. Dietary supplements are regulated by the FDA, but much of our role begins after product enters the marketplace. Mm-hmm. In fact, in many cases, companies can produce and sell dietary supplements without even notifying the FDA. Okay?
That is wild.
So that led me to think, how do you define what is a supplement then? A dietary supplement is a product intended for ingestion that, among other requirements, contains a, and this is in quotes, dietary ingredient intended to supplement the diet. Mm-hmm.
That's anything.
Basically, this means I could go out, ground up some dandelions, and because they have protein or iron in them, market them as a dietary supplement and sell them. And the FDA will not do a damn thing until somebody starts choking on them.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that is the problem. That is a huge problem here in terms of how a product gets to market. Now, the way our capitalist economy works, you're allowed to sell anything somebody wants to buy. So I understand that. I understand how the FDA has its hand full when it comes to food and drugs and a lot of other things. So this kind of falls under the radar. Mm-hmm. If that's going to continue to be the case, because to regulate this, I mean, all of the phony garbage that's out there that calls itself a supplement, and you could call anything a supplement, is basically my point here. There does need to be another step. I don't know if it's giving the FDA more teeth. In my personal opinion, you have to go to the sellers. The sellers have to understand more about the product that they're selling. This is just like the eye drop deal.
Yeah.
This is just like some other things that have come up.
Oh, you mean
here.
The retailer?
Yeah.
Gotcha. Yeah, yeah.
They have to understand what they're doing, what they're selling here, basically, and put out as many warnings as possible. And quite honestly, I don't think just telling them you guys should do this to be a good corporate citizen is enough. You're going to have to give them some sort of incentives, some sort of motivation, almost like a retail whistleblower, if you will, that basically this company came to us, wanted us to buy their product and sell it in our stores or on our sites, and we found this garbage in it.
Mm-hmm.
And let the FDA know so they can be proactive about it. Some sort of incentive program that way, because if we don't get after, I mean, Amazon won't even recall this.
Yeah, yeah. They won't even take it off their digital shelves, which is mind-boggling.
Absolutely, especially after all of this.
Yeah.
So if they're not going to do it just because it's the right thing to do, you're going to have to figure out a way to incentivize them, or this is going to continue to happen, and it's going to be a lot worse than the things that we've experienced so far.
Well, in Amazon, or like retailers, I mean, maybe, I don't know if there is a financial penalty big enough that would create any change within such a giant like Amazon. But I mean, you could make it hurt a little, you know, for making these choices.
Gotta do something.
Fun EV, who is joining us live. Good to see you, Fun EV. Thanks for hanging out. Fun EV says, I believe it is a jurisdiction issue. FDA needs an act of Congress to give them the power. Well, let's give them the power, because according to the CDC, misbranded dietary supplements frequently contain potentially dangerous substances. As supplement use continues to increase throughout the U.S., it is important to remember that, like we all said, the FDA is not approving these compounds and their side effects have not been studied.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what is terrible is that even though I have known this for the better part of like two decades, that still doesn't stop me from any time I see like a supplement advertised just being like, I don't know, I think that might be the one.
Oh, really?
Really?
Well, no, I just, well, like you think about it, you're like, well, okay, so I take this tejocote root and then I don't have to make any other changes in my life and boom, pants are fitting better. I like a simple solution.
Man, I get paranoid about even prescription medication.
Yeah.
And understanding that more.
No, I do, but I'm just saying, like, I'm super paranoid about it, but it's crazy how, like, you can see that messaging and just be like, well, maybe I'll give it a shot. Like, or what was the cinnamon wave that happened a couple of years? Was it cinnamon?
The cinnamon wave?
Yeah. There was a cinnamon wave where everyone was taking supplements and one of our friends, like, started losing his hair because he took too much of it.
What?
Yep, gotta be
too
careful.
Too much cinnamon can actually, like, kill you.
Yes. Toxic. Yeah, it's wild.
You guys, cinnamon has a dark side. I didn't even know about this.
No, up until that point, I'm just sitting at the gas station tossing buckets of cinnamon into my coffee because I'm like, I'm only helping myself. And then a friend is like, my hair fell out. It's like, come again.
Okay.
Yeah, which is again why the FDA needs to have the power to regulate and study the side effects of these supplements. So when I talk about how long this has been out there, and we're talking about white yellow oleander, which creates nausea, vomiting, dizziness, diarrhea, abdominal pain, cardiac changes. That was the one that really stuck out to me.
Mm-hmm.
Like it changes your heart. And it goes back. One of the cases I found was from September 2022, where a 2-year-old kid in New Jersey suffered severe symptoms after eating it from finding it around the house. Another thing that we really don't have time to get into is how not only these aren't regulated, but the packaging also isn't regulated. Mm-hmm. So a lot of times there's not even child safe packaging for these supplements. Anyway, we just have like every story this week is just a can of worms.
Yeah.
Where it's just like, for another day, am I right?
Okay.
All right, our next most popular story this week, our next can of worms, if you will. Tesla to cut more than 10% of workforce. Tesla is cutting more than 10% of its workers, which will likely mean more than 14,000 job cuts. According to an internal memo, Tesla needs to reduce costs and increase productivity. Electric says the writing has been on the wall. In the weeks leading up to the memo, Tesla managers were reportedly being asked to identify the critical team members on each team. You know, let's just say hypothetically you could only keep a handful. Who would they be? No reason. The company also paused bonuses and canceled performance reviews while cutting production in China. The memo from CEO Elon Musk also suggests that the company's rapid scale led to redundancies in workforce. But others say it's the slow rollout of new models, lower delivery volumes, and multiple price cuts. In the memo, Musk said there is, quote, nothing he hates more than having to lay off staff, but that leaning out the organization will enable Tesla to be, quote, innovative and hungry for the next growth phase cycle. And I just really feel bad for him here.
There is nothing that he hates more.
Nothing he hates more.
Absolutely nothing that Mm-mm. he...
So maybe the SEC.
I was going to say regulators, definitely. Like, no.
Okay. If he could do anything differently, he would.
It's just, I mean, they are victims of their own success.
I guess so. Except for any observer of Tesla and the automotive industry at large and their transition to EVs could see this coming. I think, obviously, so Tesla did a very good job of taking its market advantage and then making such shoddy business decisions that it wound up making that advantage worthless. I say that for a few reasons. One, Elon Musk has and continues to alienate buyers with his like very unnecessarily political, polarizing, highly publicized opinions. He needs to stop talking.
Mm-hmm. Well, It's not even talking. He's just reposting GIFs. And you're like, what are you doing there?
What are you doing there? Yeah. Tesla has cut their prices too many times. And as we've discussed this in the past, this is like a losing game for everyone. Yeah. Buyers who have paid for new Teslas like last year have seen they're holding now heavily depreciated vehicles. Some of them are underwater on their loans. That is not a good way to retain customers. The pre-owned market is now flooded with vehicles that have lost value. So new vehicles lose value because of that. This is having an impact on profits for not just Tesla, but for every automaker. And finally, the Cybertruck rollout has been a bit of a disaster. There's been reports of quality issues, intermittent shutdowns. It's just not an easy place to be. So with all that said, these cuts may have seemed foreseeable for some. I mean, it seems
just one of these many.
One of these many things. Something has to give somewhere, right? Mm-hmm. What I did not see coming, however, on the heels of this job cuts announcement was Tesla asking to vote to reinstate Elon Musk's $56 billion pay package that was voided by a court. An announcement that was literally made the same week this job cut announcement was made. 14,000 layoffs.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So from a sensitivity standpoint, I'm really not feeling that. So the lawsuit challenging this pay package was filed in 2018. It was not a clawback. Basically, the point here was that people are contending that Elon Musk has had undue influence over the board when they approved that pay package. And the board is obligated to put shareholders' interests ahead of their own. Mm-hmm. And so now in the context of today's market and declining stock value for Tesla, a murky market ahead, I don't know. I mean, I don't see this getting reinstated. However, like, it was so distasteful to me to see these two conversations being had in the same week.
Yeah.
And if you look at what $56 billion could do for the company.
For any company.
Yeah. A company that needs to shed 10% of its workforce to get leaner and meaner. And restructure. But we have like that, I mean, that $56 billion that we already had earmarked, which Funny V called out as well, just like, it's bad. bad timing.
It is really bad timing. And like, I don't know. I mean, I know that like the board wants to position him as like this wonder boy that would not, Tesla would not have been a success without him. And maybe that's true, but it's not a success right now. I don't think it's, you consider it a success story the way it's navigating the market that it was designed to be in. Mm-hmm. It's really not playing well in there right now. And so I don't know. I think you have to consider that maybe that's a sum that exceeds the value of your part-time CEO. Just saying.
Well, part-time, yes, being very gracious. $56 billion divided by 14,000 people laid off. And that's probably, that's the low end, right? Because they said it's likely going to be more than 10%. Yeah. $4 million a person. So you think an investment of $4 million per employee could help make some positive impact at Tesla. But Jeff, this is never a company that we talk about in terms of getting tone right. You know, according to Business Insider, some factory workers found out that they were laid off when security scanned their badges and sent them back on shuttles. According to CNBC, some former workers received incorrectly low severance packages, and security workers in Fremont, when they were asked by employees why their badges weren't working, they just said, if your badge doesn't work anymore, you don't work here anymore.
Wow.
I mean, and this is all, we've talked about it so many times, just in terms of like toxic from the top down, but also like it can't be, I don't know, for, like a lot of these Tesla employees are such diehard believers that sometimes when they see what the other end of that looks like in terms of how your company is operated, it can be a brutal reality.
Yeah, it's interesting, you know, that Business Insider article that you referenced there. I think they also talked about an 18-year vet of the company that also basically resigned in after seeing a lot of this other stuff that was going on. Yeah. He was one of the people who was critical in launching the company. He was a crucial product design engineer. And I guess what this – when I saw this announcement, it made me think, well, Tesla is just like all of the other car automakers right now announcing these types of layoffs because of sort of misdiagnosing the EV market.
Yeah.
And I think it was a big opportunity for them, you know, with Tesla and all the stuff you guys have mentioned in terms of the messes that they've gotten into, 100% accurate. And we've talked a lot about those things in the past and even saw a lot of these things coming. But this is also a company with like $29 billion in cash reserves. Now, that's not completely liquid, okay? That's access to $29 billion. So if they really want to be a different company, I think this was an opportunity for them. Where do they have issues right now? People aren't buying EVs. Mm-hmm. One of the biggest concerns right now with that is range anxiety. Isn't this an opportunity then to expand your charging infrastructure? Do something different than what everybody else is doing. Capitalize on this wave that you could have been riding for much longer. If, to Anna's point, your CEO would have kept his mouth shut.
Yeah.
There could have been a really positive sentiment and swelling up for Tesla right now, but they've kind of crushed that. So expand your charging infrastructure to help the consumer feel more comfortable buying your vehicles. You've got issues with the Cybertruck. You've got issues with other with autopilot and other things. You've got trouble with door handles, okay? Yeah. Take some of these individuals, and even if it's not an apples-to-apples fit, I understand that, but don't talk about the layoffs as much as we need to restructure. Mm-hmm. We need to take some of these positions that are we tried to grow and expand and scale too quickly. We're going to go back to some of the things that made us successful as a startup in terms of developing a better product.
Yeah.
Invest there. Everybody else is cutting now. Yeah. Come out with an announcement that says we are taking this and we're reinvesting in different places. There's some painful stuff we got to do in order to do that. We have to cut some operations people, but we're going to reinvest in product development. We're going to reinvest in our infrastructure. We're going to reinvest so we have a better product that's easier to get to market that people are going to enjoy. That's what they could have done here. And I just think it's a really a missed opportunity because now they just sound like everybody else and they still have to scale up at some point to compete with the Fords and the GMs and the Nissans of the world, the Toyotas of the world. And cutting 14,000 production workers isn't going to help you get there.
Well, and it wasn't just production workers. It was a lot of engineers too.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, we've talked about it multiple times on the podcast, but the companies that invest during the downturn, even if it's specifically in R&D and innovation, those are the ones that come out ahead. And that's been one of the things that Tesla is good at. And Funny V says, you do have to give Tesla credit. They sold the number one vehicle in the world, which was the Model Y in 2023. Anna, do you see the Model Y holding that crown next year?
I don't. I, you know, fair point, Funny V. But if you look at their latest earnings, their margins are taking a beating, first of all.
It was like down 30%, their stock, right?
And secondly, well, their stock is down. Yep. Yeah. And then secondly, their deliveries are down. And so if you look at, you know, I mean, I'm not going to belabor it, but like, you know, they are tailor made for this market. They should have come into this this EV market with a competitive advantage. And you've seen that get like chipped away over the last year, I feel like. And so now it's just unfortunate for Tesla that they're not in a better position to handle it because, as you mentioned, the competition is coming hard and fast. Yeah. And then Tesla, you know, then what happens?
Well, and if you look back to the last time the automakers were in so much trouble, 2008, 2009, it wasn't because of the number of vehicles they were or were not selling. It was because the margins were so bad on them. Mm-hmm. We talked about all the price decreases that they did earlier in this year. That's never going to help.
Yeah.
I mean, so they did kind of dig their own hole here.
Well, and, you know, all the other automakers that are sort of chasing Tesla, quite a few engineers out there right now that might be looking to land somewhere else.
True.
It also just the way it was executed so poorly, it caused so many logistical problems. Like in Sparks, Nevada, workers faced a 2-hour line just to get into the facility due to these badge checks. You know, it just could have been done so much better than just like, you know what? Turn off 14,000 badges and don't let anybody else know.
They just seem to operate on two different poles. Either things are going through the moon wonderful, or they just cannot dig a hole fast enough to hide themselves in. It's crazy.
I read too that they're in Fremont, like because they're legally required to, they're giving like 2 months of severance to everyone because it's like to comply with Warren. But there's no differentiation between how long you've been there. So you could be a 5, 6, 7 year employee.
Yeah.
2 month severance.
Yeah.
Like that, I don't know. It just feels like what a kick in the rear end if you've put like your time and effort into this and you're not even like identified as being that valued member. Cause a lot of companies will do that. You know, if you put in some time, they will, I don't know, just disappointing.
All right. Our next most popular story, our most popular story this week, how the de minimis loophole has crippled industries. The latest column from Mike Collins tackles a regulatory loophole that most Americans don't even know about. It allows foreign vendors to ship directly to American consumers without a U.S.-based importer of record filing an entry summary or paying any duty on tax or tax. All they need to do is say the shipment is worth less than $800 in their country. It's called the de minimis regulation. Collins says the de minimis loophole has crippled manufacturing industries, undermined retailers, strained law enforcement resources, and facilitated the free flow of illegal and dangerous products, even illicit drugs like fentanyl. The volume is incredible. In 2023, the de minimis rule allowed nearly 3 million packages to enter the U.S., largely uninspected and duty-free. Every day, 60% of them were from China. Collins says the new Chinese business model connects American consumers directly to mainland Chinese manufacturers. The companies that benefit are the importers, warehouses, and delivery systems like Amazon, FedEx, and UPS. Chinese companies like Shein and Temu can also ship goods directly to U.S. customers. According to a fact-finding effort by the House Select Committee last year, Shein and Temu are likely sending almost 1 million apparel shipments per day thanks to the de minimis benefit. So, how do we fix it? Both Congress and President Biden have the power to close the de minimis loophole. Representative Earl Blumenauer, a Democrat from Oregon and ranking member of the House Ways and Means Trade Subcommittee, recently launched a coalition to reform the de minimis loophole in U.S. trade law. The representative has also introduced bipartisan legislation known as the Import Security and Fairness Act. This bill would block non-market economies, namely China, from exploiting the de minimis threshold. Now, I know there was a lot in this article, Anna, but was this your first exposure to the de minimis loophole, or had you known about it already?
No, I had heard about this before. I think the article quotes AMT president Paul Scott Paul.
AAM.
AAM. Yeah. Sorry.
No, you're good.
Too many.
The Alliance for American Manufacturing.
Yes, the Alliance, yes. That org is usually on top of this type of thing, and they've made statements about it in the past. You know, it has a lot of support from manufacturing to look at closing this loophole. There's a lot of bipartisan backing, as you mentioned. So you wonder, like, or at least I did, like, who's supporting it?
Yeah.
Like, why has this not been done yet? of course, low-cost goods are going to be a benefit to someone domestically. And according to reports, effort to close the loophole have been met with opposition from the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, the Express Association of America, and the National Retail Federation, amongst others. So they say that altering the de minimis provision would drive up prices. Meh. Ultimately, passing on to the U.S. consumer and small to medium-sized businesses that utilize this provision to import parts for their manufacturing process. Okay, you know, I know cost is going to always be a consideration. I think this goes back to the story we covered earlier about the supplements industry. You can open the floodgates to enable every supplier under the sun, and of course, this will reduce prices, but at what cost? Mm-hmm. You know, as Collins points out, the race to the bottom that comes with Temu and Shine, which are like Walmart on steroids, if you've ever seen it, what goes on those websites.
Oh, yeah.
This doesn't help American manufacturers. Like, this doesn't support American jobs. And to be honest, like, you should stop buying from them. Like, really, they've been tied with like slave labor. Mm-hmm. The clothing is like things are so low quality. It has a terrible environmental impact. I'm going off on a tangent right now. This is not what I was going to talk about, but like, but there are a lot of reasons to not do business with those companies.
There's an incredible amount of waste just due to how poorly the business is run.
For sure. And so people get, you know, they get lured in with these like $5 t-shirts or whatever it is that they're selling, or and the product that you receive is sometimes nothing like what you ordered. Mm-hmm. There's just so much waste involved. It's just, they're bad companies. I would guess that shipping those items direct to American consumers is a lot of what is going through this de minimis loophole. So not great. And then also, I think, you know, to your point, you have to consider the lack of duty and the costs that are associated with not having any money tied to those packages that come in. And, you know, that's a lot of money that could go towards funding things like infrastructure that we need to support, you know, global commerce. But anyway, it's, you know, it's influences the trade imbalance. I mean, there's a lot of reasons without even getting into the fentanyl aspect, mm-hmm. but there's a lot of reasons that this needs to be addressed.
Well, I was surprised to see the National Retail Federation opposed to it. I mean, the Express Association of America, that makes sense, right? Mm-hmm. That's the UPSs and the DHLs of the world, the people delivering this.
Right.
I mean, that makes a lot of sense to me. I did actually, you had mentioned Scott Paul's quote. I did pull that out also. The de minimis loophole means that our trade laws are granting bad actors like, and it's Shine?
I think so.
Okay. Shine and Temu an outrageous advantage over American manufacturers. These Chinese companies have built billion-dollar businesses by exploiting de minimis, hooking American consumers on below-bargain basement prices, and supercharging a retail race to the bottom.
There you go.
It is, it really is a retail race to the bottom, Jeff. We're like, I mean, I feel like it's a topic of conversation all the time. Like, whether or not you pay a little bit extra for quality, or it's just, I can buy five bad ones for what I can pay for one good one. And you kind of just like roll the dice that maybe you get a sweatshirt that lasts more than two washings. I don't know. I think that it definitely is a symptom of a greater problem with consumerism. And I think that at a minimum, maybe having these shipments cost a little bit more or go through a little bit more of a rigorous process isn't necessarily a bad thing.
Agreed. I mean, I can't argue with that, but here's the reality. We have been trained since we were small to find the best deal, okay? Yeah. That has just been put into our brains, and it's also ingrained into a lot of small businesses. And it's easy to say, hey, it's just going to cost a couple bucks more, all those things. And by the way, I'm not disagreeing, but when you're talking about sourcing different materials, electronics, a lot of different stuff like that that people can get for pennies on the dollar because it's not going to be a real durable or harsh environment that it's going to be used in. Going through a different bus that's going to add more taxes and fees and everything else to it is going to impact some smaller manufacturers and retailers. It just will. Now, do we want to bite that bullet because it is jobs? There's a trade-off there between manufacturing jobs and service jobs. Which way do you want to go? I haven't done the research enough to know what it would mean if we started implementing greater restrictions on some of these packages coming in, because remember, it is an American consumer who's making the choice to do that.
Yep.
Now, does there need to be an educational aspect involved there saying, do you realize what you're doing here? You are buying, you know, five t-shirts for 15 bucks, but that creates this much to the landfill. That does this when it comes to improving manufacturing jobs. This is going to impact what the minimum wage is allowed to be. This is going to have all of these other sort of hard-hitting elements to your daily life, more than just saving the 10 bucks on that t-shirt.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't done that. That would be one step, I think, in trying to reinforce why this is a bad step. When it comes to the de minimis thing here too, and I like Mike, okay, and I like the points that he brings up, but he paints with some really broad strokes here.
Yeah,
we can do some things to preserve some of those cost savings because either whether we like it or not, we like buying stuff from China. Mm-hmm. Okay. I'm not going to lie. I got stuff that's got a China tag on it. Okay. But we don't have to do this to everything. He says there's a huge issue with fentanyl. Yeah. You would think we could put some sort of restriction into this law that says this does not apply to any biological good.
Whether it's
candy or supplements or pharmaceuticals or whatever you want to call it, this doesn't apply. We need to be looking at this stuff before it comes in the country.
Yeah.
Same thing with textiles, potentially. Mm-hmm. If we really want to make a concerted effort to bring textile manufacturing back to the U.S., this is a place to start. I would agree. I think if you try to do it as a broad stroke, there's going to be some really critical immediate impacts that would be very difficult to get past. But I think there are things you can do to ease this into being, especially if we're going to continue on, which I think is a very positive direction, in really being careful on how much we're sourcing from China going forward. There is a place to start here. I wouldn't do it all at once, though, I guess is my point.
Well, in defense of Mike, I mean, this is a column, not a white paper. You know, the what he's trying to do here is kind of alert more people to the issue. And I think he did. That's why it would be – I think that's why it was the most popular on our site, because I think so many people don't know about this. One thing – Timu wasn't even on my radar. Maybe it was for you guys, but if anyone watched the Super Bowl, that company spent at least $15 million on ads, and the world got to know about them real quickly.
Mm-hmm.
I certainly know that's how I was introduced into our household. The Wall Street Journal said that this de minimis loophole caused imports to surge from 150 million packages in 2016 to 720 million in 2021. 440 million packages were from China. And Jeff, I agree with you. A great first start, which you can't believe it's not in place already, is fentanyl. You know, I think, again, this is something that seems to have pretty bipartisan support. I hope that you could have universal support over illicit drugs coming in.
No such thing as universal support.
It's just like, who's the person that comes out and he says, I just think we need greater access to illicit drugs.
It's that whole Second Amendment argument. If it starts there, where's it going to stop?
Yeah.
That's always the mentality.
Funny V, who I'm going to guess is Doug, but either way, good to see you, Funny V, if you're new. It would be great for Amazon to put the carbon footprint of each thing you buy. It may give people pause. Oh, man, talking about it for years, Funny V. That would be incredible. And we'll see. We'll see.
Mm-hmm.
We'll see. This also made me think, because I kind of contributed to this recently, unknowingly. Like, because one thing that we could really crack down on is Chinese counterfeiters that are cloning websites without anyone's knowledge. So I like the company Dixon. I don't know if you noticed, but I happen to wear quite a bit of flannel day to day. it's an incredible company that makes a quality product. They're also known for making work shirts, right?
Mm-hmm.
So again, the algorithm pings me on a Dixon warehouse sale in Facebook. I click through, it goes to Dixon's website, right? And everything is like fire sailed from between $5 and $10. I was just like, whoa, things do not look good for Dixon, but I'm going to get while the getting is good. And I loaded my cart full of stuff and I checked out and it all seemed legit. And I'm like, wow, this is such a great sale. I'm going to send it to my friend, producer Eric, and my brother as well. And when I pasted the link in there, the URL changed. And I was just like, that's not a good sign. And I clicked on it and it took me to an entirely different type of site. That was an entirely different, like, cloned website. And I can't believe that. And so I was angry about this. I looked at Dixon on social media and they had all these posts about like, this is happening and we can't stop it, right? Now, we had talked, I had mentioned briefly in passing about some of the issues we have maybe had in terms of running into some social media jail. And by we, I mean just myself. But so I reported these ads, right? I clicked on one, so I'm getting thousands of them now. I reported every ad to Facebook. And every time I reported them as nefarious and spam, they have rejected me in terms of and refused to remove the ad. And that is just crazy to me that I can say, I know this is a counterfeit website selling counterfeit goods that charged my credit card. Take it down so it doesn't do it to anybody else. And they're like, doesn't meet the criteria to get it removed from our platform. You know, we like to make sure do their due diligence whatsoever about everyone that's paying to be on the platform. And I'm just like, just say what it is. They're giving you too much money for you to take it down. And it's just, I mean, that's another place where I think in terms of starting and getting rid of counterfeit goods that are sold on social media.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
Have you gotten the shirts yet?
No, I got a shipping confirmation there somewhere. I mean, maybe within the next year I'll get them, but I don't know. Like, seriously, this he sent in this column, like, and a day later, I was just like, should have read that column a little closer. But seriously, that website was identical. Like, you wouldn't have been able to tell any different.
So they're really going to send you shirts?
I got a confirmation code. I don't know if I'm getting I've talked to other people that this has happened to. And sometimes you'll receive the goods and it'll be kind of like the old school when you would buy it out of the back of a car and like the tags would be ripped off or it would be slightly altered, you know, the like.
Whoa. How many shirts have you bought out of the back trunk?
No, just, I mean, like, you know, it used to be big with like purses, you know, and I've bought a lot of purses out of the back of a truck. Just like, yep, it's legit.
This is such a David story.
This is not. This is everyone. This is everyone this is happening to.
A little bit of a David story.
It's not a David story. It's happened to close friends and loved ones. All right. Well.
Of David.
Before we get into, in case you missed it, we have another word from our sponsor. Hi, I'm David Manti, and with me today is Rob Milner from FLIR. Rob, we hear a lot about the machine whisperers out in the industry, but there's a very simple problem out there that these machine whisperers still can't catch what they can't hear. So what can we do about it?
Well, we give those guys and everyone around them the ability to see sound and save.
You're going to see sound?
You can, yeah. We can actually make sound appear like a hotspot on a visual image. Makes it really easy to use, and anyone can do it.
That is incredible. I look forward to talking about it more. Please join us. Join Rob and I for our discussion, Acoustic Imaging for Manufacturing, How to Capture Cost Savings Through Sound. And we're back. Up to 30% of your plant's total compressed air capacity is being lost to leaks right now. Download this new video podcast from Teledyne FLIR to learn about how manufacturers are using acoustic cameras to catch these problems in real time. And if you'd like to sponsor the podcast, you can reach Industrial Media President Tom Lynch at tom@ien.com with sponsor the podcast, one of the many things you oversee in the subject line.
Wait, so he's president of this entire company?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, yeah. It's the whole ship.
Makes
the whole ship. See, I found humor in just saying that he was the president also of this small sliver of it. To which, you know, there was some debate as to whether or not that'd be confusing. And I don't want there to be any confusion.
David, your new title is Executive Senior Vice President of the Today in Manufacturing podcast.
I'll take it.
All right.
Can I have a higher title?
Let me pull up.
Super Executive Senior Vice President.
No. I got to I was already changing my LinkedIn profile. All right. I guess we'll just put a pin in it for now, guys.
I would put a pin in it.
Put a rooster on it.
Official pin putter. All right. In case you missed it, stories that maybe not as popular on the website, but still stand to make a big impact on the industry going forward. Anna, what was your in case you missed it this week?
So this is kind of a quick one, but it stood out to me just because of it was a GM story. Mm-hmm. And it was about how they're moving their Detroit headquarters to a new downtown building. So they're moving to a new office downtown, and they're going to work to redevelop their iconic home along the Detroit River. GM CEO Mary Barra said that the move to this brand new state-of-the-art office building in the heart of the city will help GM recruit talent in the future. The new site's about a mile north of the Renaissance Center, which is where they were before. But it keeps the company's headquarters in the city for the foreseeable future, which is great. You know, that Detroit needs those anchor companies to stay. But I think what was interesting to me is, so she described it as a workspace that's going to be modern and new and that really fits the way people work today. And it's definitely going to be an attraction. And I picked the story because I think, like, you're seeing more and more companies do this kind of thing, making the type of adjustments where they shift their headquarter location to more of a downtown area or a more of a desirable city, or remodeling or rebuilding their existing headquarters to make it a better office environment with more perks and a better layout. And I like seeing this stuff because, you know, businesses are paying lip service to, you know, wanting to recruit and retain Gen Z and like the younger workers and stuff. And like, nobody wants to work in your dank, like, cube farm. They don't.
Yeah.
And so, like, sometimes that means you got to invest a bunch of money into, like, making your place, you know, a desirable place to be, especially if you want people to not beg to work from home. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think the office environment of the past is sort of in the past now. There, you know, people have higher expectations than, you know, half walls made out of carpet and, like, no windows. And, you know, it just... These are the types of changes that companies are making to really harness that younger workforce or even older workers that just, you know, they want a fresh and new place to work. I mean, it's like part of feeling positive throughout the day. And I think that stuff does have a big impact. So
who is the monster that created the cube? Like, I want to know like, what's ground zero for cube innovation? Where they're like, you know what? Look at this space. We could easily get 300 people in this space with tiny little foam and carpeting cubes. And then there were people that were like, my God, that's brilliant. Just brilliant. I mean, maybe things were just getting too, like, cluttered working at, like, tables family style when you were in, like, a call center. I don't know. You needed a little more privacy, sound dampening.
I found out.
Oh, Robert Probst.
Inventor of the cubicle.
The inventor of the action office that evolved into the cubicle office furniture system.
Yeah, I mean, it's just got to be just like a modular office kit, basically, yeah. Right?
So he thought he's just changing the world. He's like, whoa, 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 no, this is an action office and we can change it up.
Yeah.
You know, multiple configurations. One day it's like this, next day it's like that. And they're like, no, we're actually just going to keep it like this forever.
I know.
And build it on top of each other.
It doesn't matter that this is a warehouse and it's, yeah. We're going to put some action offices in here and... there's no heat, though. Sorry.
It's like the company that sells you those modular couches. You know, it can be this way. It can be that way. You can flip it over and sit on the other side. And it's just like, no, once we have it the way we like it, it's kind of just going to stay that way.
Yeah, forever. No one's going to flip it.
Jeff, your thoughts on GM staying in Detroit?
The thing that stood out to me is the picture that they chose of Mary Barra. She looks so happy.
She's so happy. She's like,
yeah. She's so excited to be moving into her new office.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, there's clapping.
Yes.
Yeah.
She's pleased.
She is very excited.
Yeah.
No, I agree with everything, kind of what Anna was saying. I mean, in terms of really investing, and I think it sends a great message not only to the city, sends a great message to your current workforce and those that you're looking to recruit that they matter.
Yeah. You know, yeah.
We just got done with the Tesla story where basically they didn't find out about losing their job until they scanned in to go to work. This is the other side of that coin in terms of really showing people that you care and investing in the business. I think also, you know, their GM hasn't had a ton of great headlines lately either. You know, they've had some workforce reductions and everything else. So, yeah, good story.
We're gonna take care of you as we do this building.
Yeah.
You're not going to be working here, but you can come to training here. No. Jeff, what's your In Case You Missed It this week?
So I picked a story. It's called Protecting Ships from Cyber Terrorism. And I like this one because it goes into a lot of different areas. It starts out with basically talking about the Francis Scott Key Bridge and the fact that right after that happened, there was conversations between the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, the CISA, CISA, as well as the Department of Homeland Security. So it kind of plants the seed that it was an electrical issue that was going on there. We always have to look at the cybersecurity perspectives because the systems used in a ship of that size is very similar to the type of networking that you would see in a production facility, in a manufacturing plant. This is an OT environment, basically. And these types of environments are becoming much more prominent as we get more connected, okay? Mm-hmm. Whether it's in a production manufacturing plant on a ship like this, could be a fleet of semis, could be railroads, could be a lot of different things where if the hackers understand how to get into an ICS, they can understand how to get into these other types of systems. So it just lays a really interesting groundwork in terms of laying all that out, understanding what this means and the potential ramifications. I mean, if this, for example, not trying to spur any conspiracy theories here, but if this was a cyber attack and a successful one, they can replicate this in other places and think about the damage that hackers could do. And then when you translate that to a lot of state-sponsored hackers really targeting infrastructure right now, you know, the biggest one that we've been talking about recently is the whole Unitronics hack. And that started basically with some folks in the Middle East going after Israeli water wastewater treatment facilities, not really even thinking about the fact that that same PLC was being used around the world.
Mm-hmm.
So when they issued that attack, it wasn't just Israel's wastewater facilities. It was places all over the U.S. as well. So, again, understanding that there's a lot of similar technology, similar endpoint dynamics, similar connectivity concerns in any OT system. This was a really interesting article and just kind of makes you, again, more aware. Mm-hmm. And I don't bring these articles up to be like doom and gloom, but we're having more of these conversations in manufacturing right now. The more times we're talking about this, the more we're talking about it, the less low-hanging fruit goes unpicked, okay? Yeah. And the more we're paying attention to all these things that we can do to at least make the hacker's job a lot harder, because if they can't get into your system in the easiest way, they're going to go someplace else, and it'll just keep going. The more time and energy they have to expend on something, the less likely it is they're going to use that mode of attack.
Well, it has to be part of the conversation, right? It's why we cover multiple safety stories throughout the week too, which is actually going to be mine in case you missed it. But keeping it in the conversation so that way people are mindful of what's happening and try and prevent it going forward. Yeah. Jeff, kind of piggybacking on this story, it reminded me of a couple days ago, we posted a story about how the FBI was investigating the crash. And I'm like, oh no, what are they going to find? Because I actually, before this article was published, I was like, you know, there were some rumblings about as to whether or not it was a little bit more nefarious than accidental. Yeah. And man, you just got to get through a lot of the paragraph where it's just, or a lot of the article until you're like, oh, they just want to see why they left, because they were already experiencing electrical issues at the dock. So like, why'd they keep going, or at the port? Yeah. And it's like, whoa, 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 put that farther forward. Not just like, well, the FBI is really looking into it and we're not really sure. It's just, because I had the same thought, just like, especially when we talk about the size and impact that these cargo vessels can have, and talking about them being likely autonomous in the next 5 to 10 years.
Yeah.
A lot of potential there for bad actors. Anna, what did you think about this story?
Yeah, I mean, I thought the same thing. I just, you know, you think about cybersecurity and on the most base level, you're thinking about like my computer, mm-hmm. you know, yeah. my computer, my phone, like that's where you're worried about hackers. But as Jeff often says, like the more connected systems and technology that's involved in anything, the easier it is to get into. So yes, just awareness of this, the fact that it's, you know, it's here for maritime, it's here for your vehicle, mm-hmm. Just making sure that people aren't like checking out on that side of the story is important.
All right. Mine, in case you missed it this week, was about a major auto supplier who's facing fines after a fatal crushing accident. Last October, a 26-year-old employee at Forcia Emissions Control Systems in Franklin, Ohio, was fatally crushed. According to OSHA, the worker had been on the job for about a year and was placing cardboard under a machine that bends vehicle exhaust pipes at the time of the accident. The company is a subsidiary of Forcia North America, which, if you remember back in 2022, combined with Hella to form Forvia, one of the world's largest automotive companies. The accident triggered an OSHA investigation, and now the company is facing $314,000 in fines after the safety agency found that the death could have been prevented if only it provided proper machine guarding. In 2022, the company was cited for similar violations at the same location. Now, at first, you think I chose the story because it's just like, okay, another accident story. Learn from the mistakes of others. Lockout, takeout, machine guarding. It is surprising to me like how often you still hear about how these things are bypassed just because they don't make sense. Well, if they don't make sense, you got to make them make sense or fix the problem. You know, you're designing machines that are creating some of the most intricate parts in the most intricate components of the most intricate things in the world. You can figure out how to get the machine to turn off the power when you're maintaining it. But that's not why I picked this story. OSHA issued 10 instance-by-instance citations, and that stood out to me because I was like, what is an instance-by-instance citation? Well, in January of last year, the U.S. Department of Labor issued guidance on the expanded application of instance-by-instance, or these IBI citations, for high-gravity, serious OSHA violations. Now, OSHA officials can apply these IBI penalty adjustments as a deterrent. Previously, these things only applied to willful citations, but OSHA thought that if you made it a little bit more expansive, it could incentivize employers to proactively prevent workplace fatalities and injuries. It would also give OSHA regulators another tool to help ensure safe work environments, especially when dealing with repeat offenders and catastrophic accidents. This is why I picked the story, because we talk about OSHA needing more and more teeth to, basically stop bad actors in their tracks, where you get sick of how many stories where it's like, they were there 2 years ago. They've been there seven times. And it's just like, you know what? We know that it's bad now, and we're going to have this. We're going to basically elevate it immediately to make sure we kind of stop this in its tracks. And I don't know if you had a chance to read the story or know much about the IBIs, but that was what of this story stood out to me in particular.
Yeah, I saw the story, and the IBIs is really interesting. I agree with you completely. We talk about how, what can OSHA do to be more impactful and, getting a little bit creative and making this a higher penalty situation. I think that you want to say that this helps it to become a deterrent.
Yeah.
But there's so much, I don't know.
Are you going to do the sigh with the "we'll see"?
There's so much carelessness. I think there's so much indifference. People like rolling the dice. And like you said, if something is designed in a way where it's not being operated correctly, there is a lot of like workarounds that take place in manufacturing, and people don't really see the gravity of those risks until something like this takes place.
Yeah.
That is the biggest deterrent, unfortunately, is a coworker, somebody in your plant losing their life. I hope the IBIs help. I really do. Because that shouldn't be the way people get the message,
No, I agree. But Jeff, sometimes you would see a penalty for something like this and you're used to seeing 31,000. Maybe the fact that it's 314,000, maybe that makes a bit of a difference.
I think it's a great additional step.
Yeah.
We'll not argue with it. I mean, I'm the guy who's been talking about more teeth for OSHA and a lot of these other government regulatory agencies for quite a while.
Yeah.
I just, and I know we've talked about this to death as well, but we keep coming back to these safety issues are culture issues. This is a cultural thing where just not enough attention is being placed to this. And I've come around to the mindset that, yes, these fines are definitely a good step, but maybe we need to go a step further and almost do like some sort of public forum where whether it's the plant managers or upper brass at this big automotive OE have to come in and basically explain to the public, here's what happened.
Yeah.
Just so you know.
Oh,
and they have to actually explain in detail what happened in their facility to their employee and to this individual. And then talk about, here's how we're going to make sure it never happens again.
Yeah.
Because that accountability element, when you're writing a check, especially for a company this big, now $300,000 is a lot of money.
No, but you're right. It's a huge multinational company.
Yeah. And they're going to appeal and it's going to get reduced and everything else. So a good first step. And I like the IBI type deal in order to escalating these fines, but there has to be something where these folks have to get their hands, pardon the phrase, get their hands dirty in these situations to really have it hit home. Because unless you're forced with it and more than just a report from the plant manager saying, yeah, we had a safety incident and this occurred and unfortunately this is the result. No, dig into it. You tell us what you think happened. Mm-hmm. Okay. And you put it in your own words and be confronted with this incident. I think that's what it's going to take.
No, and I get that there it's you want to be delicate because there's a victim involved. But I mean, it is sometimes difficult when you hear, you know, a worker is placing cardboard under a machine that bends exhaust pipes, and then you got to leave it to your
own
imagination.
What in the world is that individual doing? It, because that's what he was taught.
Yeah.
That's what he was shown to do.
Gee, I think it was a group. I'm not certain.
This individual. Sure.
The individual, yeah. but yeah, it was, I look to kind of follow this and see if it does make any change. But Jeff, you raised a really good point. Like, not just more accountability, but knowing exactly what happened in the situation.
What do you, when your boys do something wrong, what do you make them do? What did you do?
Well, the third time, fourth, fifth time when I say it, and hopefully they're listening. No, you just...
what did you do? What did you do wrong? You make them tell you.
Yeah. And how do we prevent it going forward? And hopefully they haven't stopped listening to you by that part. all right, let's move on to our final thoughts before we get out of here this week. Anna, what's your final thought?
I had a really fun morning today chaperoning a field trip for my daughter's third grade classroom to, it was like a community garden in our town. And, I have to say, like, it was like this really drizzly rainy day. And, those kids just went crazy digging in, like out earthworms and feeding them to chickens and, watching these kids eat fresh, vegetables from this garden. I know like one of Avery's friends hates vegetables, but was like excited about being there and trying things and stuff and just watching them like get really invested in what they were learning. And it was just like a really fun day. And it just reminded me that like, you know, sometimes if you get away from the grocery store and get the kids to like either a farmer's market or an actual farm. And so they can really see like how it's all done. That's like not only interesting for them, but also very educational. It was just a really fun opportunity today. So,
I mean, I like when you can see that you've helped connect the dots for them. Mm-hmm. Like, it's so much different pulling the carrot out of the ground and eating it than just like, no, carrots come from the grocery store.
Right. Yeah. You know? Yeah.
We're still working on, when we're at Grandpa's farm, that the cows wind up in the freezer, but, you know, that's a little bit, it's a different learning curve, you know? But I agree with you, Anna. Like, it also helps, I think, when it comes to like more of a circular supply chain and people have a better understanding of where their food comes from, I think it's good for everybody.
Yeah, it encourages you not to waste it, I think, which is also an important lesson for a kid. So
true. Like when they see how much goes into like actually getting that carrot to grow.
Yeah.
So, all right. Well, talking about our kids, my oldest celebrated his birthday this week. So I just wanted to say happy birthday to Desmond. I hope you enjoyed it and continue. We have the big celebration tomorrow. So that's where we should hopefully have a little bit of fun. But I wanted to get your guys' opinion because, you know, it was just a simple family birthday. And I was charged with making the cake with a Ghostbusters theme. You know, all right, no frills. We're just little party for the family.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just want to get your honest feedback on this cake. I made a Ghostbusters cake And I was pretty critical of it. I'm like, but at least you kind of get, you get the gist, right?
Solid.
Oh, yeah.
That's solid.
I wouldn't say like hashtag nailed it, but I'm like, I wouldn't be embarrassed if people saw it. So
I think that's great. Yeah.
Okay. Okay. I just wanted some like honest, because, you know, a couple people in the office that saw me like cutting the Ghostbusters logo out of paper, they're just like, not going to ask, but this is where it went. Like, just made like a little stencil and with some powdered sugar. So,
no, very good work, cute. Man.
Yeah.
Okay. You did thank, it. Oh, all right. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Do they
it.
Still make the Ecto coolers?
Oh, Ecto cooler was the best.
I don't know. And if they do, I think you can still get packets of it. I don't know. I'm speaking out of turn. I have no idea. But I'm going to dedicate the rest of this evening to figuring it out.
I was never a huge Ghostbusters fan, but I did like the Ecto coolers. Mm-hmm.
You didn't like Ghostbusters?
I just weren't bananas. Yeah, I watched the cartoon. I remember that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I forgot about the cartoon. That was awesome.
Man, he's just full in Ghostbusters mode right now. And I am loving every minute of it. Every minute of it. The proton pack has just come light years ever since.
Who had more fun with when Dez came into the office, Dez or producer Eric?
Producer Eric was pretty
had a good time.
Yeah. I know that it was a good time, but I know that it's going to create a learning curve because, you know, when mommy was dropping Dez off at the office, she was trying to tell him, like, you got to like pay attention and you got to be quiet and respectful. And he's just like, daddy just plays with his friends at work all day. And it's just like, well, yeah, but like also there's working, you know, and just try to show him like.
I wasn't sure who had the higher pitched squeals, Eric or your son. Well, oh, was Eric?
Eric says he did. But man, he came in hot. Like Dez was in the door two steps and we already had a snowball fight. I was just like, all right. You know, we like to have fun here.
Yeah.
Jeff, what's your final thought this week?
Well, you know, we talk a lot about like the machine whisperer and trapping all of that organic knowledge in the manufacturing plants and all that. We kind of had a similar experience here this week. Our production guru, our lead production person, Denise, was on vacation this week. And I thought I had everything covered in terms of, you know, we cross-trained and whatever could possibly come up. But we found one thing. Of course, that we did not go over. And that was the one thing that came in this weekend. So a healthy reminder about that whole thing, how we preach about capturing all that information, that native data or know-how and all that.
The tribal knowledge.
That's real. That's real.
So come back, Denise, is what Jeff's saying.
Soon. but we did figure it out, but not as quickly as she could have, certainly.
No. So. I mean, man, love Denise.
Yeah, she's awesome.
Critical resource.
Yes.
All right. Well, before we get out of here, please make sure to like, share, and subscribe to the podcast. You can also help us out a lot by leaving the podcast a positive review on whatever platform you use. If you want to email the podcast, you can reach Jeff, myself, or Anna. Well, David@IEN.com with email the podcast in the subject line. You can also subscribe to our daily newsletter. Make sure you get it delivered to your inbox first and subscribe on YouTube at IEN Magazine so you can join us when we go live every Thursday at 2 p.m. For Jeff Ranke and Anna Wells, I'm David Manti. This is the Today in Manufacturing podcast, and we'll see you next week.